experiencing houselessness. I applied for that and was lucky enough to get hired.
So DV is a contributing factor into homelessness. How many shelters are there in Portland that you know of?
For domestic violence?
Yeah.
We check 9 domestic violence shelters, but that extends beyond Portland. So that would extend to Washington County, Clackamas County, and Clark County.
Okay, what is the likelihood of getting into these shelters?
It's really difficult to predict when shelter space is going to open up. And as I'm sure you know, there is a much, much larger need than a shelter's capacity to fill it. So I've worked with people that just because of timing, they've been unable to access shelter in a domestic violence supportive system for many, many, many months. And then every once in a while, I'll get someone that calls that day and gets into shelter. And that's incredible.
Okay, so that's one of the challenges that is a challenge for women to get out of their domestic violence situation. So what are other challenges that women face?
When leaving domestic violence?
Yeah, when choosing to leave.
Well, I think that when an individual is experiencing domestic and sexual violence, it oftentimes, the relationship doesn't begin that way. So a lot of times I'll talk to folks that will identify that when they first met this person that they now come to see as their abuser, that individual was incredible. That person was charming. And there's a lot of love there and a huge feeling of loss and confusion and emotional pain. A lot of times there's an abuse that happens over time. And by the time someone is ready to leave a domestic violence situation, their support system has been damaged. They have experienced financial abuse. They are isolated. Maybe their abuser has made it impossible for them to access a phone. So in addition to there being a lack of systemic support available and an inability of DV services to meet the needs of these individuals, there's also a kind of stripping of power or perceived power that can happen when a survivor is in a domestic violence relationship that can make it challenging for them to navigate what resources are available. I would say too, as we know, domestic violence is the number one cause of houselessness for women. So not only is it something that leads to houselessness or the experience of houselessness, but also once people are experiencing houselessness, they are oftentimes targeted by abusers. Not only are they leaving a DV relationship, but then they're going to experience further abuse once they are without housing. Another piece to consider too is that once a survivor is leaving a domestic violence relationship, that's the most dangerous time of the relationship. So of course we know that survivors are leaving in an attempt to secure longer-term safety, but in that moment when they're making the choice to leave, that's often when the abuser escalates their behavior. I think all of those things really contribute to some of the barriers in leaving a domestic violence relationship.
Do you want to explain safety planning and survival mode, as in that's the next step that I guess people would have to do?
Right. So that's a lot of what I do. I'll meet survivors either by doing outreach in the community or they'll call the crisis line. And oftentimes I am in the position of telling them, I'm sorry, there's no shelter space. We don't have any money to provide you with a voucher. So we're going to have to try and navigate this situation creatively. A lot of times that looks like safety planning. All of the advocates at PWCL are trained in safety planning. We follow a specific model and have certifications to ensure that we are coming from the most informed place possible. It's a really individual practice, I found, though. I feel like, for me, the things that I consider are a person's individual concerns because they know their situation best. They have a better sense of the abuser's patterns, of what times are safe and what times are not. When I think about safety planning, what I think about is the goal of it is to support survivors in accessing their inherent strength and capacity to survive while navigating an incredibly dangerous situation. So if I'm working with somebody that is trying to navigate leaving an abusive situation, we'll talk about, all right, when is that person near you? When is a safe time that you can leave? What support systems can we set up for you to access after you leave? And if that doesn't look like domestic violence shelter, are we accessing the houseless service system? And can I connect you to a point person there so that you feel safe and comfortable navigating those resources? If they're going to be staying in the situation, which there are many, many reasons why that option makes sense for people in that moment, it's going to look like, how can we minimize your risk? So if you sense that things are starting to escalate, do you have a support person that you can connect with? Can you stay in certain areas of the house where you're less likely to become confined? Do you have maybe a person that camps near you that can watch out for you or that you can alert if you need support? Things like that. It's so individual. I always I always wish that there was a way to have something more standardized. But I actually do know that there's talks about creating a standardized format to inform safety planning for survivors experiencing houselessness. So that should be something exciting.
What can friends and family do if they believe somebody's in a unhealthy relationship or if they're trying to escape in some way?
I think the most important thing to do, honestly, is to provide survivor-led support. A lot of times I'll work with people that their family members will, or friends or support system will get really burnt out or scared or fed up with supporting them. And there's a lot of feelings of blame, like why is this person staying in this situation? And I think I have compassion for those people. I understand it's really challenging to watch someone you care about experience suffering like that. But I think it's essential for us to provide support where we trust the survivor to be the expert. If we pressure someone to leave before they're ready, a lot of times that looks like that person may be going back. And what we know about that is when a survivor leaves and returns, the danger is increased. So I would say, go ahead and express your concerns. Share with them, I care about you. I'm concerned about your safety. Maybe connect them to one of us if possible and let them know if you can withstand that emotionally, that you're there to support them either way. And if you can't be that person, which is understandable, can be really triggering and painful for some people, perhaps you can facilitate another connection in the community. Like I mentioned, a connection with the crisis line. Because we can be that person that supports them, helps them work their way through the challenges while hopefully accessing their internal coping and safety capacities. But also when they are ready to leave, if that happens, we can guide them through that process as well. So I would say offer survivor-led support, share information, but ultimately, if you can support their choice, I think that's going to facilitate the most lasting change going forward to increase their safety.
And then at the crisis line, do you guys do that support for friends and family as well?
Yes, yes. I could actually tell you a little bit about everything we do.
Sure.
So we offer 24-hour crisis intervention and support to survivors and folks impacted by domestic and sexual violence, as well as those that are involved or impacted by the sex industry. That looks like a couple of different things. So you can call the crisis line and get immediate emotional support and safety planning. You can be connected to an advocate for ongoing support. We also provide connection to all of the local DV shelters. So what that means is that we call all the shelters every day at 9 a.m., get a sense of when they will have openings, and then we get a sense of which shelters are going to best fit the needs of the survivors calling. So we really can facilitate that entry point into domestic violence shelter. We also do connections to other resources. For example, we will work with the youth continuum or houseless agencies. We'll work with culturally specific agencies. So we really try and serve as a central point to support survivors in getting their needs met. In addition, we have specific advocacy positions. So in my position, I get to work with survivors experiencing houselessness. And that's a pretty big deal because currently the domestic violence system and the houseless system work separately. So I have the honor of trying to find a way to connect those two systems to help support a survivor. We also have a specific advocate that works with folks impacted by the sex industry, an advocate that works with folks that identify as youth, and an advocate that works with folks diagnosed with developmental disabilities. And when you're set up with ongoing case management or ongoing advocacy with one of those advocates, we can go beyond that crisis intervention and work on longer term.
Organization you're with? Sure. My name is Deborah K. Adams, and I am the National Program Director for National Women's Coalition Against Violence and Exploitation, and I'm also the Washington State Director for Unite Women.
How did you get involved in this type of work?
Actually, my story stems from very personal experience. A long, long time ago, I separated from my abusive husband. The only thing that kept me from personally being homeless at that time was I had one supporter in my corner who happened to be my mother, and she was able to help us out. And I actually lived in that house for a year before they evicted us. Yes, human trafficking, it is a crime against a person. The big deal about human trafficking is that It is against the law. It's against state laws, and it's against federal laws and international. And it involves coercion, fraud, manipulation, and these types of acts to make someone feel they have no other choice but to be in that position of being trafficked.
What is the difference between survival sex, human trafficking, and labor?
Absolutely. So human trafficking is the umbrella term, and there's all kinds of different types of human trafficking. So there is labor trafficking, there is sex trafficking, domestic workers trafficking, there's farm worker trafficking, there's trafficking for human organs, there's trafficking for drugs. So the difference, what they do is they usually combine two different types of actions. The first one is called smuggling, which very often takes people across borders that they may not have legal entry or permission to cross. A trafficker would say to that person, well, I can get you over there and it costs this amount of money. So the person who's being smuggled gets that money and pays it to the smuggler at the time. The smuggler brings them, delivers them to another person who's a criminal as well, and is a trafficker. And now that trafficker says, well, guess what? Now you owe me all this money for your room and your food. And if you don't do what I want you to do, I know where your family is. I can kill your family. And the person then, once it was smuggling and there seemed to be some kind of commerce going on, then it got boosted up into trafficking when they're coerced into doing either work, working on the farm. There's a lot of sweatshop places that manufacture product. You asked the difference between survival sex, and I think that is a really good question, because I know especially youth that leave their home and they think, if I run away, even if I have to live on the street, I'm safer than I was. And so what survival sex is, kind of, it's a trade. You are approached for some form of trafficking within 24 to 48 hours after they leave their residence. But I'm going to get a place to stay that's off the street, and I'll be safe for the night, and maybe there's, you know, some other things. So that's called survival sex. Youth who participate in survival sex would never agree to say that they are trafficked, because they feel like they're in control of that situation. And that's a fair assumption from their point of view. But what I know, because I'm an adult, I know that anybody under the age of 18 shouldn't have to make those decisions for themselves. And that makes the trafficker, perpetrator, a criminal, because of the use of fraud and coercion and force, sometimes literally chaining them to a bed or locking them in a room or forcing them to do things they would not choose to do, such as go out and steal something or sell their bodies to other people and then give that money to their traffickers.
So how do traffickers recruit, and like, what do they look for in a schedule of people that they're trying to?
Traffickers look for someone who is vulnerable, someone who maybe isn't feeling 100% safe at the moment, or is feeling not loved or not cared for or appreciated, or being abused in their home situation, wherever they were living. What they do is, this is very similar to domestic violence, which we call a cycle, manipulation, walking on eggshells, and then the assault, and then the honeymoon period or manipulation. So in a trafficking situation, the trafficker befriends, appears as a nice person, someone who cares about them, someone who just wants the best for them, and creates this trust between the two of them. And once they've got that trust established, then they will use that to coerce and fraudulently force people into illegal activities that they would not do on their own if they had a choice.
Do you know statistics of the amount of people that have been trafficking in Washington County?
Everybody has different numbers. There's a national organization called Polaris Project, and they have an 800 number. People can call that if they've been trafficked or if they think they know someone who's been trafficked, and they will try to work with them to connect them to the resources they need. They can also text, and the text is the numbers for Be Free, B-E-F-R-E-E. It is new, and people don't want to acknowledge that this is happening. It's a prime area for traffickers or their team members to work, and what they do is they strike up friendships with teens that they see a lot there, and they build that trust. So it's that easy for someone to be ensnared in a very dangerous situation. Seeing these huge connections between youth that run away from their bad homes, the foster care system, homelessness, any experience of previous violence, as those are all very connected to making someone a vulnerable person who is an easy target for a savvy trafficker to target, to pinpoint. It's crazy.
It is. It's so easy to just fall straight into, without even knowing.
Exactly. And someone who's, 14, 16, 18, even 22, would say, I'm doing this survival sex, and could easily find them all of a sudden enmeshed in this really harsh, violent environment where they are coerced to go out on the street and sell their body. And if they don't do it, they're beat, they're threatened, their families are threatened. Very often drug use is involved in it, because the traffickers have no problem using drug to kind of make them compatible or amenable to doing what they want. So it's very, very easy, and it can start out as a very innocent seeming relationship and then go horribly bad.
How does being houseless, or the fear of being houseless, increase the chances of being treated or trying to get out of this situation?
Right, because so you're probably already what could be termed a vulnerable person. If you've left a bad situation, if you're running from something horrible that's happened in your life, so you decide to go out on the street, well, it's pretty cold. Like right now, outside, it's freezing out there. The wind, and here in the Northwest, we often have rain, which soaks right through your clothes. Being homeless makes you a very prime target for traffickers, because you have to have your basic needs met, right? Human rights. And when we can't provide them for ourselves, we are vulnerable to attack by vicious people. It puts us in a place where we can be manipulated much easier than if I had a stable housing situation. If I had, I felt safe in knowing where I'm going to go every night. Those are things that when we don't have those as human beings, we quickly can be placed in a position of where we feel like we have no power. And if we meet someone who is showing power, and very often it's, I got a house, I got a nice house, come and see it. And the person says, well, you can stay with me as long as you need. Well, maybe it isn't the first night that you would run into this person that they would traffic you for sex or drug or put you in any kind of laboring position, but I ran out of money, and I've been taking care of you all this time. Can you help out? I know something you can do that would help out. And it's presented in that way. And so it seems, even though the youths are saying, yeah, but I never really thought I would do that, they can be convinced that it's okay, because someone they trust and care for is telling them it's okay. And so that then makes it really hard for them to say, okay, well, I'm not going to do it.
Why is getting out or escaping trafficking a challenge?
Oh, mostly because of the threats, and very often the control that they maintain over you. Like, if you were to leave, you're not going to have anything. And we can't minimize how important that is. And then on top of that, traffickers are threatening with some really serious crimes, such as they will sexually assault them. They will give them to other people who are even worse. That's another thing traffickers do. In a blink of an eye, you're across the state border. And once you've crossed that border, then it elevates to a federal crime. Traffickers want to get the people they're working with in a state of complete dependence upon them. So they will connect with someone in Vancouver, someone who is a trafficker, who will say, well, hey, I know somebody in San Francisco, let's go down there. And so you've already crossed state lines, and everybody I know is related to my trafficker, or the trafficker, and they're not going to help me either. The other people that are being trafficked, they can't help each other either, because if they do, they will have some really severe assaults, beatings, horrendous crimes occur to them. So it's so difficult. So they have a huge connection of people wherever you go. And there's always the threat that if you testify against me, I will kill you, or I will kill your family. And often the threat to kill your family is way more motivating than to kill you know, you, yourself. And then if you are the person who has been trafficked, you're thinking, I can't go back and tell my family what I've been doing. They're going to judge me. They're not going to love me for what I did. They're going to hate me. They're not going to welcome me back to the family. And sometimes young people, especially females, will get pregnant and they will have a baby. And then the trafficker takes control of that child and uses that as a weapon to manipulate. If you ever want to see your kid again, better do what I say. It's a very complex social and cultural crime. So one of the things that National Women's Coalition Against Violence and Exploitation does is we have a missing persons division. And if the police or some social service agency refers someone to, and we call it NWK, then we have a national network. And in the last year, we worked in 12 different states. What we're doing is helping the family negotiate the system. Getting the media to pay attention to the fact that their loved one is gone is key, because sometimes the law enforcement reaction to someone saying my youth is missing is, and we can't do anything about it. So I just cringe when I hear that word runaway, because I think that's someone who felt the only option was to leave where they were at. It's not an excuse not to search for them. And especially if you have family and community members saying, we want this person found, what can we do to find them? And so often it's pressure from the media that can more quickly engage the law enforcement aspect of it. And I'm not saying that's always the answer. If we ever want to change the public's opinion about people who have run away from something horrible in their life and are in a place of vulnerability like that, we need to change our laws and change the way we think about things. I did want to share, too, another huge connection for trafficking youth is the internet. You know, the internet is a huge benefit to us in the 21st century, but if we don't use it wisely, if we aren't careful to protect our youth, then they can easily be trafficked as well. It's very frightening to think about how easy it is to find themselves in that trafficking situation.
Yeah, like what is there to look for? What could you do to like interfere a little bit? Like, hey, what's, you know, are you okay? Or what's going on?
Yeah, first of all, you have to have your eyes open, your mind engaged, and you have to notice. So then you watch for physical cues. Do they look like they've been fed, cared for? Are they clean? Do they have decent clothing? Do they have like scars from like burn marks, bruising? Now the traffickers are very wise, and they teach their people to call them daddy, friend, or my boyfriend. That of course seems like a natural relationship. Just kind of keep your eyes out onto that. And if you could observe when they leave, what kind of car they get into, write down what the person is wearing, what both people look like, you know, just being aware. And then maybe saying, calling, you can call the Polaris Project hotline. And the thing, if you get a chance to talk to them, do they know where they're at? Do they have personal effects or a backpack? Do they have that? If they don't have anything and they don't look like they've been cared for, that could be a clue. Maybe if you think they're 14 and they look in kind of, you know, clothing that would make you think of selling their bodies, you could use that. And if you do talk to them, ask about that. Ask about their freedom of, can you come with me? They say, no, I can't. If they have no freedom of movement, they say, no, I have to be right here. I can't leave this spot. That might be something to watch out for. Does their health look compromised? Do they look sickly, you know, pale? When you're exposed to violence and trafficking, your health quickly deteriorates. So if you go to PolarisProject.org, they have a list of things to look for, too. But really, it's about keeping your eyes open and noticing, and then attempting to share that information with someone.
Is there anything else that you would like to add?
Well, I would like to say you could go to the nwcave.org website if you want to learn more of National Women's Coalition Against Violence and Exploitation. We're our nonprofit. Just be aware about it, learn about it, and talk about it, and educate yourself, and just know that it's happening in your backyard, you know, so to speak, in your neighborhood, in your community, and don't pretend it isn't, because it doesn't take very long for any one of us to become part of that vulnerable group of people if we are in a situation where we're homeless. If we can provide some kind of safety net, Portland area, Vancouver area, that they can be aware of, and that will help too.
Thank you. artist fee here at the Bipartisan Cafe, interviewing this community leader about her work and her vision. Joanne, you're well known for your work in police reform. How did you get involved?
I got involved before I became a legislator. I became concerned because ballot measure 11 was on the ballot, and I was so concerned because I already knew that any mandatory minimum sentencing law would have the impact of increasing the incarceration rate of African American and Latinos in the population. And there was some wonderful work happening at Multnomah County to identify the reasons for the overrepresentation of people of color. Beth Stunn was the chair, Bear Katz was the mayor, and together they were tracking every single month who was coming into the system, why, and they had the community corrections in Multnomah County jails all answering the question, why? Why do you have so many black and brown people coming into the jail? So perfect timing to become a legislator and to try to impact this mandatory minimum law that was being sold to Oregonians as this get tough on crime measure, which in fact was a one strike you're out law. But one strike laws are a new phenomena, and only Oregonians have this one strike you're out law.
Okay, and what year was that?
That was 1997 that went into effect. It was on the 96 ballot and it went into effect in 97.
So can you explain a little more how you end up where you're at today?
Because I know that there's a front-end activity that happens before people get in prison. So you figure, okay, well, if we have people overrepresented that are African-American and Latinos in our criminal justice system, where's the first impact? And the first impact is the cop on the street, the neighborhood cop that supposedly knows who lives in the neighborhood, why they're in the neighborhood, and really engages the community in a community policing effort. And so what I saw was African-American and Latino and other kids of color were being targeted by police in ways that were invisible to the general public. For example, Portland police do what's known as a walk and talk, and sometimes they call it mere conversation. But when they're talking to young African American and Latino youth, what that means is they ask for ID, they ask them to prove why they're in the neighborhood that they're in, they ask them if they can search them, but that doesn't show up in the traffic stop data, right? Because that's mere conversation. And when you ask police, well, why aren't you tracking how many people are being impacted by this walk and talk or mere conversation, their response is they're free to go at any time. Well, what I know to be true is that if you're black or brown, you are not going to turn your back on a police officer. If you feel powerless in your community, there's no way you're going to turn your back. So it's just an illusion in police officers' minds that people are free to walk away. The data we track, traffic and pedestrian stop data, shows us that if you're African American, you're twice as likely to be stopped. If you're stopped, you're twice as likely to be searched. So Portland police aren't even good at racially profiling people, right? Because they're not finding criminals. What they're doing is harassing communities. And so I've been doing this, I realized, for over 25 years. The reason I do it is so many people who are impacted can't voice their concerns. Because if you complain against the police harass you and target your family. When I listened to Erin Campbell's mom talk about how her family was harassed and followed and intimidated after they killed her unarmed son. I mean, can you imagine that? It's bad enough that you are experiencing violence at the hands of people who are supposed to protect and serve you, but after they kill your family member, then they start harassing everybody else in your family if you file a lawsuit. Well, since that's the only venue we have today is to file a lawsuit, why would people not file a lawsuit seeking justice? We know we have what's supposedly called an independent police review that isn't independent, doesn't review the police, and in fact throws out 77% of the complaints that come in every year. So who's crazy? Is it the public that's crazy? And they actually don't investigate. They only review the police investigation to determine if the police acted appropriately within what the investigative report says. And so if the police is targeting someone, the likelihood of them saying to an investigator, oh yeah, I targeted them because they were black or they were poor or they were houseless, and that's why I went looking for something. Expecting that to happen just means that they think we're crazy. And so I do this because so many people who are impacted don't have a voice, don't know who to talk to, won't go to the independent police review because, of course, the outcome is most of the time when the police did nothing wrong. And so community members still die, community members are still being harassed, community members are still being intimidated, but the system that is supposed to protect us is a woeful failure. And so as a community, we need to make sure that the police remember that they work for us and not vice versa.
I sort of want you to talk about the DOJ hearings yes. that just happened and what you heard there and anything you heard about how houseless people are treated.
Well, I wish that more houseless people had taken the opportunity to come and talk in front of Judge Michael Simon. The federal fairness hearing took place on February 18th. I think the DOJ, the federal judge, the city of Portland, the Portland Police Association were totally caught off guard. Hundreds of community members showed up to share their stories with the federal judge. And what was fascinating was the federal judge listened. The federal judge made access to people who couldn't show up that day by letting them submit written testimony, videotape testimony. And this particular judge read everything. And so when people got up to testify, if they submitted written testimony, he would say to them, I read your testimony, and he would be able to quote from their testimony, right, while they were doing their presentation. So I was so impressed that we got a great judge. And so what the judge heard was a lot about how people are treated by the police and how there is no avenue for them to seek redress. What the judge heard a lot of is, as the DOJ called it, our self-defeating accountability system. You may remember that the AMA Coalition for Justice and Police Reform in 2011 asked the Department of Justice Civil Rights Division to come to Portland and do a civil rights investigation of the impact of over-policing on African-American men, because we have had too many unarmed African-American men die at the hands of Portland police, but yet people have died because of the police perception of who they were in the neighborhood. Ironically, the Department of Justice came to town and did a bait and switch. We asked them to investigate the civil rights violations against African Americans. They came in and investigated civil rights violations against people with mental health issues or people perceived to have mental health issues. When we asked them about the bait and switch, they gave us two responses at that time. One is that the current United States Supreme Court does not allow for a claim of racial prejudice unless you can prove intent. And you may remember that in the New York stop and frisk case, the only way that got to federal court was because some brave police officers recorded the roll call where they were told to go out and target black and brown people for law enforcement, right? And so that's the only way that got to federal court. That was one of the answers they gave us. The second one was because they could only go back 18 months, they could not prove the case of racial bias. And why they could only go back 18 months was because if you're gonna file this with a federal court, they only have a limited time period that they can look at. And so they gave us many excuses as to why they didn't do what we asked them to come to do. But we were also concerned about what happens with people with mental health issues, because some of the African-American men who had been killed had a mental health background. They had some issues with their mental health, and they either could or could not get treatment, depending upon who you talk to. And so it wasn't that we weren't concerned about that. That wasn't our ask. But this is what we got. So we thought, okay, they found Portland police did, in fact, violate the civil rights of people with mental health issues or perceived to have mental health issues. They uncovered some egregious behavior by Portland and police officers who are called to do welfare checks and end up tasing and beating and just brutalizing community members. And so as a community member who had been working on these issues forever, I was like, hallelujah, the DOJ civil rights division's in town, they're gonna kick butt, they're gonna take names, we're gonna have justice finally for people who have been shut out of this process. Well, this is not my parents' Department of Justice civil rights division. In fact, this civil rights division is a ludicrous example of a solution that doesn't fix the problem that they identified. And so if the problem is Portland police brutalizing people with mental health issues, and we're gonna invest $26 million to fix it, giving most of that money to the police is not, in my opinion, the appropriate venue for those dollars to be spent. Directing Portland Police Bureau to create a behavioral health unit so that they become first responders for people with mental health issues is the most ludicrous example of government thinking that somehow you can all of a sudden make all Portland police officers officer friendly. And if you read the findings in the investigation, we know that there must be police officers that probably would be appropriate to take those calls, but we need to know who they are. And since we have no criteria of identifying who they are, I mean, people volunteer for this unit. Humphreys is in this unit. Humphreys has a history of brutalizing community members, right? The first police officer that was hired was the Multnomah County Sheriff who helped stomp James Chassie to death in broad daylight downtown Portland. And so this is why this is so important. And so when we talked to the federal judge, what we said was, the Department of Justice doesn't represent us. We don't know who they represent. But to come up with a settlement agreement that puts the violators of our constitutional rights in the driver's seat is insane. And the judge heard that loud and clear. So what's interesting, the lawyers to respond to 13 questions that Judge Simon sent out to them. Based on his questions, you don't have to be a legal scholar to believe that he believes changes should be made to the settlement agreement. I think it's going to be the downfall of the Department of Justice, the City of Portland, and PPA, because from the beginning, they have absolutely refused to make any changes to the settlement agreement. And so, if they tie the judge's hands, the judge will have no choice but to reject the agreement and force Portland to trial. And so then there will be a trial date set where Portland police officers will be on trial, and then there will be a adjudicated verdict as to whether or not they are guilty of violating civil rights of people in the city of Portland. Now, the city of Portland doesn't want that. The Department of Justice doesn't want that. PPA certainly doesn't want that. But the people want that desperately, because you cannot fix a problem that has not been acknowledged. And ever since the DOJ came to town, our current police chief keeps saying, oh, it's not us. It's the broken mental health system. Oh, it's not us. But if you read the findings, what you find is that police officers are brutalizing community members who call for help. And that is not okay, and it's not acceptable. And so while the Department of Justice is paying attention, while the federal judge is determining whether or not to accept these settlement agreements, Reese rolls out two new policing programs in the city of Portland. One is Stop and Pat program that's exclusively developed for black and brown youth, because what they're supposed to do now as Portland police officers is to spend 15 minutes of every hour involved and engaged in community dialogue. Community policing, they call that, right? But in order for police to feel safe, if they're talking to certain community members, they have to pat them down before they can have the conversation. And so I have asked over and over, are you patting down white business owners right in downtown Portland? And so are you patting them down? Of course, they haven't answered that question for me yet. And I don't expect them to give me an answer. But I expect if you're going to do it in one part of town, you're going to pat people down all over town. You're either patting down everybody or nobody. And it's so ludicrous to think the DOJ is paying attention. And they do press releases all day, every day, to tell them how wonderful these new programs are. So that's one program. The second program is Prosper Portland, which is a program that was designed and developed specifically to make the houseless community invisible downtown Portland. And what's ludicrous about it is a process whereby you criminalize being homeless, and then you enhance the penalties every step of the way. So for example, if you get the first ticket for loitering at a place that's boarded up and nobody's in and nobody's walking past, then you could get a ticket that basically excludes you from being in that area, right? That police officer sees you again in that area. Now, you are going to be charged with interfering with a police officer, right? And it is called COPP, the Chronic Offenders
Pilot Project,
right? Again, Reese is ingenious when he sells these programs to downtown business owners, because what he said was, this is for those people that come here in the summertime and they just want to live on the streets of downtown Portland. And we want to stop those young people from coming and using the streets of downtown Portland as their home. How they're implementing it is on the homeless people who live in the city of Portland. Guess what? It's not summer. Nobody's racing to get here and sleep on the street. The people who are sleeping on the street are people who live in Portland, who work in Portland, who have family in Portland, who worship in Portland, and those are the people that are being targeted. And so here's what happens. First, you get the ticket that says you're excluded. Then all of a sudden, you are interfering with a police officer, right? So guess what? If you're homeless, you're not getting a reminder to show up in court 30 days from then. So then you've missed your court date. So now there's a warrant for your arrest. And so what was your original crime? Being homeless. And that's not against the law. And so, but what this police chief does is create these fancy programs with fancy fancy names and fancy packages and then sells it to the public like this community relations program. And in fact, what it is set up for specifically, both of these programs, is to target segments of the community that the police chief believes have no power to fight back. And as a community, we have to show we have the power to fight back. And I have to say, where's the mayor? I haven't heard a word from the mayor.
Right.
These programs have been in the media for the last couple of weeks. I think the mayor may still be in South Africa, right? I'm pretty appalled that these programs seem to always roll out when the mayor is out of the country. And so who's in charge? We got a police officer that's working as the community liaison between the police department and the community. I mean, who thinks that's a good idea?
We've really noticed a lot more crackdowns. I mean, people reporting getting a lot of tickets for just erecting a structure, just surviving. And if you say anything, then they're saying you're interfering with a police officer, so then you get charges. And in fact, Ibrahim Mubarak was arrested 2 weeks ago.
Yes.
Just for very simply stepping on a parking lot.
Right.
And the minute he said anything, they charged him with interfering with the police officer.
Right. And so, and I hope the public is really going to pay attention to this case. I mean, it's unfortunate that someone with as higher profile as Ibrahim was arrested, but I think it also does so much for the community that he was arrested because he uses his voice very effectively. And so people will know that if this can happen to Ibrahim, someone who is very well known, very well connected at City Hall, speaks truth to power on a regular basis, if it happens to him, what about the people that don't have a voice in this community?
Right.
And that's the part that scares the daylights out of me, because if we don't pay attention now, when the weather does get nice, it's going to be worse. I mean, every summer, Portland Police rolls out a program that they say will do one thing, and it does something totally different. But what it has in common is that I believe it violates the constitutional rights of people who don't have the power to fight back. And I think the only way that we fight back is collectively,
yes.
Right? Is that we collectively call the city council and stop letting the rest of the city council off the hook. Just because we have a police commissioner doesn't mean the other city council members aren't responsible as well. They're all responsible for the settlement agreement. They're all responsible for police oversight. And when the next person dies at the hands of the police, the buck's going to stop with all of them.
Okay.
And it's just a matter of when, not if. It's going to happen. And then if we're not prepared to make sure that they are held accountable. They love hiding behind, oh, that's not my bureau.
Right.
Well, guess what? Today is your bureau.
Right, right. I think that's true, too. I really think, and you can't say, oh, that happened before me. You know, you are all in charge of
that's
the
right.
police department.
That's right.
What do you see as some victories in this movement?
Oh my gosh, the biggest victory is getting in front of Judge Michael Simon and him asking the hard questions that community members have been asking for well over two decades, right? I mean, he wasn't snowed by that fancy presentation by the DOJ in the city of Portland and all this kumbaya, we're all in it together and yeah, this is going to be great. The DOJ wants the public to trust them. They've done nothing in this process to lead us to believe that they are trustworthy, right? Amanda Marshall, who is supposedly the oversight for this settlement agreement, came into our first meeting as a community when we're hearing the results of the findings, saying what a pleasure it was to work with Portland Police. Oh, and how much she enjoyed working with them. And I said, are you crazy? Do you know where you are? Do you know why we're in this meeting? Oh, I work really closely with them on trafficking cases, child trafficking cases, and I just think there's some really good officers there. And so we're supposed to trust that she'll put aside her good working relationship with Portland police officers and all the federal stuff that they're doing for the people. I don't trust her. I don't believe it. I just so hope the biggest victory will be that the judge rejects the settlement agreement and sends Portland police to trial. Because I believe if the judge does that, oh, they'll want to negotiate a new settlement agreement because they don't want an adjudicated verdict from the people in the city of Portland of how brutal Portland police officers are, depending upon what part of the neighborhood you live in, what your economic status is, and what your race or gender may be.
Okay. I wanted to ask you just to tell the listening audience a little bit about your experience when you ran for office. Some people may not know that about you.
Oh, yeah. It was a couple of lifetimes ago, yeah. But... Well, I was fortunate because Senator Abel Gordley was my House member. I'd worked on her campaign a little, you know, not a lot. Our senator was retiring, so she called me and said, I want you to know I'm resigning my seat because our senator is retiring and I'm going to run for his seat. And I went, oh my gosh, who's going to represent me? And she said, you. And I was like, you've got to be kidding me, right? People ask me what I think. I tell them, you know, and it's like, I don't think that's good if you're going to run for public office. And so she gave me one of the best pieces of advice I ever got from a political person. What she said to me was, I want you to call 50 people and tell them that you're thinking about running for office. And listen to what they say, but more importantly, listen to what they don't say. By the time I made those 50 calls, I was a candidate, and wow. I was off and running.
Wow. And do you want to share any of the lessons you have, in particular for women, because we're doing a women-focused show today?
You know, I have to say that when I ran for office, I went to some of those political schools, right? As a brand new elected leader, I thought, oh, I'm going to go to these schools, and they're going to help me develop my platform, and they're going to help me think through some public policies. And I was so disappointed, because most of the trainings that I went to wanted to teach me how to act and be more like a white male, right? Most of the trainings I went to told me I would have to straighten my hair. They told me that I would have to not wear so much ethnic jewelry. And so what I realized was that there is not, today now exists organizations for people of color who want to run for office who don't try to suck the color out of them.
Yeah.
Right, right. Yes. When I went to trainings and people would tell me, like, so I said I wanted to work on Measure 11. It's coming down the pike. I want to be on judiciary because I want to have an impact on this. And I remember clearly being at this training and this woman saying to me, what you need to do is find an old white retired cop and have him be your spokesperson on that issue. And I looked at her and said, then why the heck am I running for public office if I need an old white cop to speak on my behalf, right?
Right.
And so I realized that these schools served a very limited purpose, right? So I took what was good, you know, fundraising strategies, you know, how to develop your message, those kind of things. And the other stuff I just totally ignored because I figured if I didn't wear my ethnic jewelry and if I straightened my hair and I did all the stuff they told me to do, I would not have recognized that person that was a candidate for office. And so when I talk to people, it would not be a genuine conversation, right? And I figured, you know, if they're not going to vote for me because my hair's not straightened, then I don't really need their vote. You know what I mean? And so I think women have to have much more confidence in who they are and not allow people to dictate to them what a candidate looks like. What I found was when I went door to door, people would bring their whole family to the door to get involved in political conversations about what they cared about and what mattered. I went and said, I'd like to represent you and I'd like to know, what do you think the most important things are I should work on? And when you ask people that and you genuinely listen, people get that. People get that you genuinely care. People get when you say, you know, I don't know about that, but I'll go find out and I'll come back and have another conversation with you. And when you do that, people trust that. I was just overwhelmed with joy when I realized that people were willing to let their dinner get cold if they thought you cared about what was happening in their life, right? And one of the other things I learned as an elected official, my very first session when it was over, I sent a report card to my constituents, to every household, all 48,000 households, and said, how did I serve you? The response rate was astronomical. I must have got about 60% of the responses back.
Wow.
Just astronomical. Most of the responses people were, I have been voting for 20, 30, 40 years. No one has ever asked me, you know, how'd I do, right? People were just so overwhelmed that I just took the time to just ask the question. And there were people that thought that I just represented the black people. I don't know how they got that, you know, and I was just a couple, right? But for the most part, people thought I represented them well. When I voted for something that they didn't agree or if I voted against what they agreed, they said I took the time to listen. And I think women do that so much better, right? Because I knew who I represented when I went to Salem, and I represent those same people today. The people without a voice in our community, right? For me, I was in the right place. I had the connections because I was deeply connected to the grassroots community, and I never lost that. And so people ask me today, so when are you going to run again?
Yeah.
It's like, what I know is I don't need to be in office. I have a voice. I use my voice. And if I can be most impactful in public office, then maybe I will run again in the future. But, you know, there are a lot of ways I can use my voice to have impact. the stuff I do for free, it's because my heart's there and I have to do it. I mean, when you see as much as you see in our community and you see people that are in desperate straits through no fault of their own, and the systems that are supposed to help them are failing. And then what are we doing? We're blaming the people because the systems are failing, right? So we got to fix that. So that's why we do what we do.
Okay. Who are your heroes?
Yeah. Who are my heroes? Immediately, my mom comes to mind. My mom and my dad, actually. Both very limited education. Both very hardworking. My dad was a longshoreman, so becoming a longshoreman, becoming part of the longshoreman union, actually moved our family into the middle class in a way that would have never, ever happened without being a union member. And I have a strong affinity for labor unions because I could certainly see the difference between our standard of living and other family members who weren't fortunate enough to have a job that was part of a labor union. They are definitely my heroes because they had a vision for us that was well beyond anything we could have imagined for ourselves. So those are my early heroes. Gosh, there's just so many. Maya Angelou is one of my heroes because when I was growing up, you know, I was growing up just before Black is Beautiful became cool, right? Before Afros became cool. And so I grew up in a society that was very unforgiving of a dark complexion African-American woman. People like Cicely Tyson and Maya Angelou and folks who were clearly African women and clearly beautiful in their own right and willing to take a stand. Locally, I have to say that Bev Stein continues to be one of my heroes. When I went to work for Bev Stein, I did not believe that there could be a non-corrupt politician in the state. I just figured politics was corrupt, so politicians were corrupt. When I had the opportunity to work for Bev Stein, I found a person who, just in how she operated as a woman in the world, was very inclusive. When she put together a group of 10 people or a group of people, it was always diverse. It was always, there were always women's voices, there were always people of color voices, and it was just automatic for her. She was absolutely pure. She was absolutely committed to what's the best job I can do for the people that I represent. And so she was my model. And I was like, man. And so when she said she would support me running for public office, I thought, whoa. Maybe that means I could actually be an elected official. I was a state rep. She was the county chair. And so we were the only elected official working for an elected official in the state of Oregon. Right? It was like very, very effectively. So that if I needed to do a protest somewhere or if I needed to organize a rally, I could do it on Friday. So I had Friday, Saturday, and Sunday to do my legislative business when we weren't in session. And then Monday through Thursday, I worked for Bev. Everywhere I went, I was always clear about who I was representing at that time, right? And not known Avell Gordley, I would have not believed, A, that I could run for public office, B, I could be me and serve in public office, and C, be effective, regardless of whether I was in the minority party or the majority party. So I'm thankful to the women who paved the way for me to have that opportunity. And in fact, I felt it was my responsibility to make sure that when I left, there was a woman that replaced me. Because in my freshman class, there were 18 freshmen, and I was the only female in my freshman class.
Wow.
And so I was proud to be the only female in that freshman class. But what I know is we need many more women in public office. What I know is that women, I think, make better decisions just because women are accustomed to juggling so many different things at the same time. But once we step out into those leadership roles, what we find is that the skills that we use as a mother, as a sister, as a community connector, are vital in a political process. And so I'd love to live in a world where all the elected officials were women and that the women were the ones that were actually controlling the outcomes in our community, because I think they would be better.
Anything else you
want to
add?
No, I'm just so appreciative to be interviewed for this program, and I appreciate the work that you guys are doing and this power in the work that we're doing, and I look forward to more collaborative opportunities.
Okay, thank you so much.
It is my pleasure.
All right, well, we're wrapping up another hour of Right to Survive Radio. I'd like to thank our guests tonight, Monica Witzel, Deborah K. Adams, and Joanne Hardesty. And I'd also like to send a special shout out to the women of Right to Survive who helped the interviews for this show, Sophia Kinnereth and Anne LaFleur. Both of you are invaluable to our organization, as well as all the other women who come to our meetings and support us and do the behind the scenes work. Please stay tuned for upcoming shows and upcoming events by following us on Facebook at Right to Survive or Facebook Right to Dream 2. You can also reach us at r2spdx@gmail.com. Remember, everybody, be kind to someone today.
And you are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 7 o'clock. Stay tuned for Hard Knock Radio after these messages.
Oh, that stupid car.
Yeah, it was kind of a POS, wasn't it?
It was such a junker. We were going to donate it to the radio station.
Oh, do they accept vehicle donations?
Yes, that was the plan, you goofball. We were going to donate it to KBOO, but no. Instead, what happens? We leave it in the stupid yard, and then Bigfoot comes.
Yeah, he took it off our hands.
Yeah, he took it. He took our car. It's not like we can deduct Grand Theft Sasquatch from our taxes. We could have taken it off on our taxes if we brought it to KBOO.
Don't let this happen to you. Donate your vehicle to KBOO Community Radio before Bigfoot steals it. For more information, call 877-526-6123 or go to kboo.fm/vehicle.
KBOO is proud to co-sponsor the Triangle production Next Fall. Next Fall opens March 13th and runs through April 6th. At the Sanctuary, 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. Triangle Productions is partnering with Basic Rights Oregon in a talkback presentation after the show, which is set in present-day New York and contains flashbacks through a couple's relationship, how it began, and how it might end. Again, that's Next Fall by Triangle Productions, running through April 6th at the Sanctuary. More information can be found on the right-hand side of kboo.fm under Community Events.
The story you are about to hear is true. The names have been changed to protect the innocent.
Oh my God, like Zoe, like KBOO.
Like for sure, like Kiki. Like radio theater.
Like news.
Like bluegrass.
Like reggae.
Like rock.
Like Grateful Dead.
Like that weird stuff. Like, you know, like...
Like those guys that were like screaming.
Totally. Like, and all those like reporters.
Ladies, please. You only have to like KBOO once. On Facebook, go to facebook.com/KBOO radio and click on like. Just the facts, ma'am.
Rip. yo, this is M1 from Dead Press.
Hey, what's up? This is Boots from the Coup.
Nah, I mean, telling you to stay tuned to Hard Knock Radio.
Keep it locked.
On the move, this is Pam Africa on Hard Knock Radio, the station of resistance. Down with this rotten-ass system.
Yo, check this out. Hard Knock Radio coming at you, bringing the noise. This is Chuck D, Public Enemy number one. News, views, and hip-hop.
Peace and love. This is Azeem. You're listening to Hard Knock Radio. Real radio. From the concrete up. All the way to the sun. Keep shining, y'all. One love.
What's up, folks? This is your girl Femi representing the whole Bay Area. I'm here on Hard Knock Radio. News, views, and hip-hop. Stay tuned.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Four U.S. postal unions are forming an alliance to defend the Postal Service. The unions, American Postal Workers Union, National Association of Letter Carriers, National Postal Mail Handlers Union, and the National Rural Letter Carriers Association, all say the Postal Service is under attack. They say a congressionally manufactured financial crisis is draining the Postal Service of vital resources, and the closing of half the nation's mail processing centers has wiped out tens of thousands of good jobs. The postal unions say that corporate privatizers have the Postal Service in their crosshairs, trying to gain control over large segments of postal operations to get their hands on the U.S. Postal Service's $65 billion in annual revenues. The Postal Union Alliance stands for a public postal service, enhancement and expansion of service, and protection of good union jobs in thousands of communities all over America. American Federation of Teachers President Randy Weingarten and teacher union leaders from the UK, Poland, Denmark, and Bulgaria are visiting the Ukraine. The Ukrainian Trade Union of Education and Science Workers invited them. They'll be meeting with Ukraine trade union leaders and government officials. Weingarten says it's a great honor to be asked by Ukraine's teacher unions to work with them to strengthen their democratic institutions and support their efforts to build a brighter future for all Ukrainians through education, democracy, and the rule of law. The battle against New York City's wage theft problem focused Wednesday on El Poblano restaurant, where former employees allege they are owed thousands of dollars in unpaid wages. Some elected officials joined workers and their allies in a rally at the Queens restaurant. Selena Alvarez says she worked at El Poblano in 2012 and was not paid for most of the 10 to 12 hours a day that she worked. She has filed a complaint with the New York State Department of Labor. The restaurant has since shut down. The Coalition to End Wage Theft said the rally is an effort to highlight how challenging it can be for workers to get their lawful pay in these cases. New York State Assembly member Francisco Moya says businesses that don't pay earned wages are no better than thieves. He says some businesses victimize immigrant workers. Unions and community allies have organized to combat what they say is a widespread wage theft problem in New York City. The Teamsters are joining with UK shareholders in the multinational transport company National Express Group, calling on the company's board of directors to improve oversight and transparency regarding the company's human capital policies and practices. The company operates school bus companies Durham in the U.S. and Stock Transportation in Canada. This shareholder proposal is aimed at getting the company to adopt a meaningful and enforceable workplace human rights policy. The Teamsters say worker safety and worker rights need to be ensured at the National Express Group, which employs 35,000 people worldwide.
Workers Independent News is brought to you with support from union-owned and represented Bank of Labor, member FDIC, equal opportunity lender. The Bank of Labor is the bank of choice for unions and their members. Now you can do business with a bank that shares labor values. More info online at bankoflabor.com.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
This is Hard Knock here on the Pacifica Network. I'm Anita Johnson. Up next, we'll discuss the Art Complex, 12 rooms, 12 artists, a one-of-a-kind pop-up exhibition in a former medical office with art installations by emerging and established artists curated by...